Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Later in the show today, we feature an interview on off-ground harvesting for almonds, but we start today with more from the UN Food System Summit 2021. U.S. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack talked with the media about the summit. Here's part of that question and answer segment.
Are we going to donate the $5 billion to foreign countries or foreign systems, or could you elaborate on that?
Did you hear the question, sir?
I heard part of the question, but let me see if I could take a stab at it. I think the reality here is that we have to work collaboratively. There's a number of different ways to do this. First and foremost are the coalitions that I mentioned. I think there's a recognition and understanding that if we are going to be serious about child nutrition, that it starts with school meals and an opportunity there to make sure that youngsters receive nutritious meals at some point in time during the day. We also know that that is connected to making sure that they continue to stay in school. So that's obviously a focus. It's also, I think, a focus on making sure that the food system in developing countries is as strong as it possibly can be. And there are multiple areas of that. First and foremost, making sure that they have the infrastructure and the capacity to be able to provide access to food. That's why we'll be taking a look at providing risk management efforts to make it easier for storage projects, for shipping projects, for processing projects to take hold in these areas so that food that is available can be processed and then made available to people in country. It's also important, I think, for us to understand the necessity of fortifying food to make sure that it's actually at the nutrient level it needs to be. We're looking forward to working collaboratively with UNICEF and also with the Gates Foundation to leverage the resources of the federal government in the US to do more food fortification. And finally, it's really about making sure that in developing countries, we do everything we possibly can to avoid food loss. The reality is 30% of food that is raised in many countries is lost simply because we don't have the storage capacity or the proper transportation system or refrigeration capacity. And that's really unfortunate. And it also addresses the issue of sustainability. It's a whole lot easier to save food that's already being produced than it is necessarily to change the methods of production so that we become more sustainable. We obviously have to do both, but it ought to start with our ability to make sure that the food that we are growing today is actually used as it was intended.
Thank you.
Any particular countries?
Any particular countries was the question.
I think we're in the United States is in the process of taking a look at its Feed the Future initiative and doing sort of a refresh and rethinking in terms of how best to direct those resources. So it's a little premature to address it as to individual countries. But the point of this is to make sure that we are working collaboratively and cooperatively with nations around the world to address the goals of the United Nations and to address all of our goals to make sure that we eliminate food insecurity globally.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Jennifer Peltz, Associated Press.
Appreciate it. This is probably a question predominantly for the Deputy Secretary General. I have two. One is there a total of the pledges, financial pledges made in conjunction with this summit, or might we get one later today? And the other is, I did hear you about the desire to be inclusive in this summit, but as I'm sure you know, there are quite a number of objections to it from a roster of civil society groups, indeed from the UN's own special rapporteur. If I understand these complaints, they're that this has been too top-down, too tech-focused, and too corporate. How do you respond to that?
Thank you very much. Well, you've heard one of the contributions to food systems around the world from the United States, and we're hoping some of those countries that have got these pathways that they brought forward will benefit from some of those funds as we work with the United States government and our country teams around the world. In terms of inclusiveness, I actually don't know of a more inclusive process than the one that has been had on the food systems process. And I can say that from the point of view of taking a four-year process on the SDGs. People look at the SDGs, they see themselves in that, and we wanted to reflect that in this People Solutions Summit. Now, no one size fits all to the discussions that are happening, so we tried to crowd in as many constituencies and experiences and representation as possible. Governments were there, writ large across governments, not just at the national level, but at the local level. So local governments came, mayors came. When it came to constituencies, civil society was perhaps the most represented. Even those who did not want to come in because they didn't believe we were taking up their issues, we stretched out and had individual discussions with those groups through the whole of this process. We'll never get it right, but we can always work towards getting it right. And so for us, the pre-summit was an opportunity to bring all those voices in across over 150 countries. National dialogues were not government dialogues. They were dialogues of civil society. They were dialogues of business. They were dialogues of science, indigenous people, youth. Right from the beginning, when we set up action tracks, when we set up champions, we said, where are the youth in this? For the first time, we had three co-chairs. We didn't have two. And this included bringing in youth. Many of these youth came from civil society. So I do believe that we have not answered 100% the concerns of everyone. That I think is more than anyone could possibly do, but we've gone a long way to doing that. I've heard that this is elite capture. I'm not sure which part of it is elite, and it would be good to hear about that. I've heard that, you know, this is a colonial capture. Well, I mean, you're speaking to Agnes Kalibata and Amina Mohammed, and we are all independence babies, so there ain't no colonial capture there. We've put a process in where we have experienced being ministers on the ground for environment, for agriculture. We have been activists in civil society. We would not participate in a process that did not include people. So, I mean, I think as a DSG, I would say we've done the best we can on behalf of the SG and the UN system. All the agencies, particularly the Rome-based agencies, made considerable efforts to bring their existing stakeholders and many more. From the perspective of me as a person, I think I took this, as Agnes Kalibata did, 24/7 to get us to where we need to. Why? When we started this process, we didn't have COVID, and we went into it with COVID. We kept this process alive, seeing the food systems as the silver lining in the dark cloud of the pandemic. And I think that what we've done today is to bring that out, to show how we have engaged the whole world, region by region, constituency by constituency. And I think the real pressure right now is how do we take this out of the summit into the homework that we need to do to get the 9 years finished on SDG 2. I think that we've done, you know, good foot forward, much more to do, but we're happy with it.
Thank you. We're gonna try Minister Skinari one more time. Minister, are you on?
Your Excellency's colleagues, here I am. Hopefully you can hear me from Lisbon.
Perfectly.
I'm honored to act as World Food Programme's global champion for school meals. And in this role, my ambition is to raise awareness and generate resources for school meals. The School Meals Coalition is one of the most important initiatives coming out of the summit. Finland is proud to co-lead this effort together with France and World Food Programme to improve and restore sustainable school meals programs around the world and give children the chance to grow, to learn, and to thrive. No child should be left behind. Furthermore, there is room for improvement in many existing school feeding systems, also in high and middle income countries. The coalition includes 60 countries from north to south. I want to acknowledge and thank the countries that join us early in this process: Guatemala, Honduras, Iceland, Sweden, United States, Rwanda, Russia, Senegal, and the African Union. 50 partners are supporting these efforts, among them the leaders of WFP, UNICEF, FAO, WHO, and UNESCO have committed their joint support. Also, Dubai Cares Education Commission and London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine have helped shape this initiative from the very beginning. Finland has been providing free of charge school meals for over 70 years. They are the backbone of our education success story. And the benefits of school meals go far beyond a plate of food. These programs have the potential to transform food education and social protection systems as well. And how? by getting children back to school, especially girls. This is important now as school systems all over the world reopen, by supporting local farmers and markets, locally sourced food creates jobs, boosts local economies, and increases income for farmers. And by supporting the health and well-being of children, they receive healthy and diversified food while learning about sustainable lifestyle and healthy diets. And the return on investment could be huge. According to research, $1 invested in school meals could yield up to $9 in economic return. If we succeed, more than 400 million school children, their families and communities would benefit from the work of the coalition. Accelerating progress towards the SDGs is also a priority. This initiative could tackle at least 7 SDGs. We have now a lot of work to do, and I ask leaders around the world to work with us to define bold and ambitious national commitments. Thank you so much.
The UN Food Summit was held during the UN General Assembly in New York. Our news brief is up next. We will be right back.
Agrimayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agrimayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agrimayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlantae is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlantae wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplantae.com.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Welcome back. Here's your news brief for today. World Dairy Expo is back in person Tuesday morning in Madison, Wisconsin. After taking a year off in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic, World Dairy Expo Communications Manager Katie Schmidt says,
"We really couldn't be more thrilled to be back in person in Madison after a year off last year. And the anticipation is really truly building as exhibitors start to move onto campus as we prepare to open those gates on Tuesday morning, September 28th.
Schmidt explains what to expect at World Dairy Expo this year.
So our dairy cattle show is looking incredibly strong right now. Our entry numbers are at, if not actually above, our 2019 numbers. So looking at an incredible show. Our trade show is going to look a little different with some footprint changes that have been in the works for actually going on 2 years. We've been working on building a new trade center and readjusting the layout. So it's going to look different. There's going to be a few less companies in the trade show due to international border restrictions, but we are still anticipating an incredibly strong showing.
She adds there are COVID-19 protocols that attendees will have to follow.
that is a reality of hosting a large event in the world we live in today. So there are emergency orders published by Public Health Madison and Dane County for face coverings for enclosed public spaces. So what that means for Expo is that there will be mask required signs placed on our enclosed buildings. So the exhibition hall, the trade center, the Coliseum, and the arena building. It does not include the New Hall Pavilions or the cattle tent due to how their structure is built.
You can learn more about the show at worlddairyexpo.com. The Agriculture Secretary recently explained what he sees as market opportunities for U.S. ag exports, both from existing and possibly new trading partners. Rod Bain reports.
A record ag export year is expected in 2021. Part of that includes all-time record ag goods sales to China. And Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack believes even as the Phase 1 trade agreement between both nations is set to expire at year's end, U.S. ag exports to China will remain strong.
They need the food that we can supply. So I think there is an economic and food imperative on their part, and I think it makes good sense for us to be able to maintain some degree of connection with China.
Also from a recent Farm Journal interview, the secretary says diversification of ag trade remains essential, particularly when it comes to the complex relationship between the U.S. and China.
It makes more sense to do this in the context of us figuring out ways in which we can expand market opportunities in Southeast Asia so that we're not overly reliant on a single market. That's why we've been engaged with conversations with Vietnam to reduce barriers and why we're engaged with other Southeast Asian countries on reducing tariff barriers and SPS barriers that make it easier or more difficult for us to trade.
And long-term, Secretary Vilsack sees Africa as a great opportunity to build new and expand existing U.S. ag export markets.
That's why the discussions that the trade representative is currently having with Kenya are important, because that could be the opening to opportunities in Africa over a long period of time.
Not to mention building upon trade opportunities closer to home, such as through the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. Now, some have speculated that our nation may attempt to re-enter what was previously known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The secretary believes that some things at home and abroad must occur first. He acknowledges Congress must get behind this or any future trade agreement. Perhaps a challenge, as members of both sides of the aisle have concerns about trade in general. So to help lessen those concerns,
first and foremost, we have to build a strong foundation domestically where people feel more confident in our own economy. At that point, once we feel stronger, then at that point, and I think it makes it a little bit easier to get the votes you need to get a trade agreement through the process.
In addition, creative ways are needed to reduce trade barriers with other nations.
And prepare ourselves to be in a position, when the time is right, to negotiate potentially either bilaterally or multilaterally.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Safeguarding your herd against persistently infected calves is key to long-term success. Chad Smith reports.
Persistently infected calves, also called PI calves, are one of the greatest threats facing the cattle industry. However, many producers may not even realize those calves are in their herds. Dr. John Davidson is Senior Associate Director of Beef Professional Services at Boehringer Ingelheim. He talks about PI calves.
The BVD PI calf is produced when a vulnerable, susceptible female is exposed to the BVD virus while her developing fetus is less than 125 days of gestation. This fetal exposure can come from one of two routes. That female herself may be a BVD PI animal where she has high levels of virus circulating in her body, constantly bathing that developing fetus in utero. 100% of the time, that fetus is going to be a BVD PI calf. The other avenue is that vulnerable female that becomes transiently infected with the virus. She might be exposed to another BVD PI calf in the herd. She has a short-term viremia where the virus is moving through her tissues, exposing that developing fetus, and that calf will become a PI calf in most situations. Outwardly, it's impossible to tell whether a calf is BVD PI or not on visual appraisal.
Because they can't be identified visually, diagnostic herd testing is important. Infected calves continue to shed the virus after they're born and can have a negative impact on the rest of the herd.
The BVD virus is important because it impacts every segment of the cattle industry, both beef and dairy, within the beef segments, from the cow-calf producer to the stocker to the feedlot. The BVD virus has far-reaching implications. It has serious effects on the reproductive performance of an operation. It has immunosuppressive effects, which ultimately causes cattle to be more vulnerable and susceptible to important pathogens like Mannheimia hemolytica, Pasteurella multosta, and some others that are important for bovine respiratory disease.
He says there are steps producers can take to prevent PI calves from affecting their herds.
Keeping good records is a great start. Understanding and appreciating the maintenance of the reproductive performance, the morbidity, sickness rates in your calf crop, these are key indicators. And then when you start to have indication that there's an issue, whether it's a reproductive issue or a respiratory disease issue, any kind of performance issue there, then beginning the process to investigate that, working with your local practitioner, your veterinarian that is adept at performing diagnostic testing, helping collect the appropriate samples. The other things that we look at is very good common sense animal husbandry, good biosecurity practices.
It's also important to make sure any purchased cattle are free of the BVD virus. Davidson says an effective vaccination program is the other important step in preventing PI calves.
BVD vaccines will be on protocols at every step of the beef production system, not just having a BVD vaccine on the protocol, but really diving deeper into the details of what are the common BVD threats today, such as BVD1B. We know that BVD1B, which is a subtype of the BVD virus, we know that BVD1B is the most common subgenotype of BVD present in the United States today. So we've got to get beyond just having BVD on the protocol. We need to have the right vaccines that have the label claims against BVD1B, not only in the pre-breeding and reproductive aspect of the protocol, but also in those calves pre-weaning, weaning as they move on.
He says matching the vaccines to the current herd threats out there is an important progression in today's herd health calendar. Again, Dr. John Davidson is Senior Associate Director of Beef Professional Services with Boehringer Ingelheim. Chad Smith reporting.
That's our news brief for today. Taylor Chalstrom's up next. We will be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with Brian Walbrink, co-owner of Sperry Farms Incorporated and chairman of Almond Board of California, about making the transition to off-ground almond harvest. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate the time.
Yeah, great to have you here today. Brian, my first question for you here, off-ground harvest is part of Almond Board of California's 2025 air quality goals. Why is the Almond Board interested in the feasibility of off-ground harvesting?
You know, I think it's always good to look at where we're going in the industry. Although off-ground is not here today, and it's also not for everybody, it's really interesting to see the possibilities of off-ground. And I think that's what got the Almond Board very excited about looking at this as part of the harvest work group. So it's a look forward, it's futuristic, and we're very excited to be talking about it.
What is some of the research currently being looked at by the harvest work group, Brian?
We've had kind of an evolution of research with this work group. We really started with the feasibility on the ground, the measurement of dust. So we kind of got those things out of the way. We looked at the equipment. Now we're really on to the drying. We're really focused on the drying. Do we dry them in field? Do we dry them out of the field? I think that's the current snapshot of where the group's at today.
Brian, I just want to get your opinion on something. You know, as far as the work that the Alma Board has done with this research up to this point, do you foresee those 2025 air quality goals being met on time?
You know, I think we're in a good direction right now. You know, we have a few years left, but there's already been enormous progress. And I think just the industry talking about this as a whole is already a big win. We've already seen a dramatic dust reduction just from the equipment and from some of the evolution from the manufacturers. And I think this is such an important topic to have as farmers that we've already seen some huge gains in the first few years.
Being a chairman of the Alma Board now, what is the Alma Board, you know, planning on doing in the future to kind of get more of this off-ground harvest information out there to growers?
I think the Almond Board's role is really to be, you know, the discussion point and to bring groups that are interested in this concept forward, bring them together and kind of in this idea sharing collaboration way. We've had great participation from all the major manufacturers of almond equipment in this work group. But I think just getting the minds together and really having the discussion, this is our big event of the year. It's a one-shot deal. You know, it's 2 months, you know, very intense, very hot, very laborious for the growers. And really just notes and seeing what other people are doing, what's working, what's not working. And I feel like in farming, it's always easy to identify what's not working sometimes as it is to figure out what is working.
Brian, my next question for you here. Off-ground harvesting has worked successfully in other nut crops and in almonds in other countries. Why is off-ground harvesting so complicated for California almond growers?
I think the size of us, I was fortunate enough to take a trip to Israel and they're 90% off ground in the whole country, but you know, they're 15 to 20,000 acres. We're well over 1 million acres here in California. It was very interesting to see how their industry has wrapped their hands around around off ground. But the number one point in the orchard is the tree height. So when you get to kind of the limbs of the tree, you have to have almost 3 feet in there. Most of the California orchards are anywhere from 18 to 24 inches. So actually getting all of that equipment underneath the canopy is a feasibility issue. So I think you really have to start kind of planning this from the orchard side when you're putting the orchard in. And it's kind of this, you know, back and forth, push pull, where the industry's at, you know, if I'm ready to make the dedicated plant for off-ground harvesting. So there's a lot of different variables, but I think that's the number one factor.
Do you, you know, maybe foresee in the future, you know, you say that Israel, you know, they got like 90% of the acres doing off-ground harvest. Do you foresee the California almond industry getting to that point, or maybe it even becoming a requirement to do off-ground harvesting at one point?
I think it's a case-by-case basis. You know, we supply 85% of the world's almonds here over the course of California. So it's a very, you know, geographically concentrated area, but we're dealing with a lot of different factors. So behind me is one of our ranches. We're actually harvesting in this moment, which is really funny for the timing. But you know, we see a lot of foothills back here. So you have foothill harvest, you have flat harvest, you have big trees, small trees. So there's so many different variables. I think it's a case-by-case basis. It would be great if the industry could achieve maybe a 50% off ground in 10 years kind of thing. So it's a longer term, longer reach goal.
Brian, what really needs to happen before growers can begin making the transition to off-ground harvesting?
I think they have to have the confidence in the research. I think they have to see other success stories in off-ground harvesting, which is where the Almond Board comes in. You know, they're very good at highlighting successful stories if growers are willing to share their secrets. So it's such a huge cost investment, especially with the equipment you already have as a grower. I'm saying I already have all of this harvesting equipment. So you're saying I can't use this anymore. So there's an equipment reach, but there's also that, you know, that futuristic planting. You know, an orchard is a 25 to 30 year investment. So if I'm going to start planning towards off-ground harvest, I really have to make sure the tree's a little bit taller so we can get everything underneath it. So I think you just have to give the growers confidence that this is something that does work. It could be a great cost saver. And when you really think about it, you know, if your harvest was kind of a one-stop shop, you know, one machine came through, took the almonds out and out of the field, man, it's really nice because this is a crazy time of year for us.
I respect you saying that a lot of growers, you know, are worried about making that transition. Do you think there might be any sort of maybe incentive program in the future to kind of get more growers on par with off-ground harvest, like some of these other organizations do with maybe incentives for cover crops, that type of thing?
Yeah, there already has been some great incentives for almond growers up and down the state through air boards. And it's really like focusing on dust reduction. It's focusing on harvester upgrades. So I think any sort of incentive package that could be attached to off-ground harvesting, where it's a cost split, you get a giant credit if you upgrade, kind of thing like our tractor programs through the air boards. Yeah, definitely. It'd be a huge help. The machines are very costly. And like I said, to make that big investment, you really have to have the confidence this is where you're going.
Brian, I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, that right now, a lot of the focus, at least for the board, is on mechanical drying. So mechanical drying versus allowing nuts to dry on the ground does raise questions, again, about cost and capacity. Brian, you know, are there any alternatives to mechanical drying being explored right now for off-ground harvest?
Absolutely. I think what's really important, which we've defined at the group level, off-ground harvest simply means the almonds are not coming in contact with the ground, which is very important because there is a approach that can be taken that some companies are working on. And it's a shake and catch and a redirect. And like they grow or dry other commodities, if there was a paper or a surface laid in the tree row and the almonds and the whole shells, kernels laid on top of that, you're still off ground harvesting. So I think, you know, using our fields for drying, I think 100% is the best way to do it on a large scale. What Israel actually does, they will catch the almonds, take the almonds out of the field, and then take it to a drying location, and they'll put it back on the ground somewhere else. And looking at the feasibility, you can't really do that in California with the acreage size. So really, you got hot temperatures, you have nice airflow. So I think utilizing the middle of the tree row is probably the biggest win for the industry.
Kind of utilizing those rows instead of, you know, mechanical, those energy cost savings are probably going to be fairly substantial, I imagine.
Yeah. And just, and on the feasibility of that, right? I mean, there's only so many dryers in the state. And, you know, when you're looking, the kernel is anywhere from 20 to 30% of the total weight of the product. So really, like, looking at throwing all that into a dryer on a large scale, it doesn't seem to me, and it might to others, it might seem like that could be a good thing. But for me, to get widespread adoption, I think we got to use what God's given us out here. I think the heat, the sun, the air, I think if we can dry them out here, we're going to be way ahead.
Yeah, good sentiment. Brian, my last question for you here. Do you have any other thoughts for almond growers that are maybe looking to transition to off-ground harvest here in the future?
Get involved. You know, get involved with almond boards, show up to the meetings. Our meetings are open. You know, share secrets, hear from other people who are doing this. And it's kind of, you know, become part of the fun. You know, I think everybody's having a really good time being innovative when you can. And just join us on the journey.
Perfect. Well, Brian, thank you for being available today and coming out from the orchard to talk about off-ground harvest day. Really appreciate some of those sentiments there and some of the advice for that transition. We appreciate having you on today.
Yeah, thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
Perfect. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Shocks to the U.S. beef supply chain the past 2 years have led to discussions and study on how to improve resiliency through the system. Rod Bain and economic experts of the livestock sector look at ways that supply disruptions can be minimized and product availability is not reduced. That's in this edition of Agriculture USA.
The Holcomb, Kansas beef plant fire. The COVID-19 pandemic. The cyber attack of the world's largest meat producer. All deemed shocks, black swan events for the beef industry and challenges to the nation's beef supply chain over the last 2 years. So how can the supply chain adapt to become more resilient going forward?
Livestock producers must coordinate and commit production via contracting.
Additional operational capacity does not solely have to come from new facilities. Increased technology implementation will be critical to success.
The costs of adding packing capacity are not limited to concrete and iron. I encourage you to consider other barriers that limit new entrants.
I'm Rod Bain. And coming up, what analysts from the livestock and land-grant university sectors think should be done to make the nation's beef supply chain more resilient in this edition of Agriculture USA. A recent House Agriculture Subcommittee hearing studying shocks to the beef supply chain and how to create a system more resilient to such shocks brought together experts from the private sector and the nation's land-grant universities to share their thoughts. In terms of how the supply chain is rebounding from those shocks presently, Purdue University economist Jason Lusk and Rabo AgriFinance analyst Dustin Ahern observe.
Beef cattle system responded remarkably well. Cattle prices have been on the rise. Consumer demand is strong.
2020's cattle backlog is nearly cleared. Year over year, cattle prices are already improving and should continue to do so through the second half of 2021.
Yet in terms of what should be done going forward, Lusk notes that an understanding of history within the cattle market is important in crafting future supply chain flexibilities.
There are long lags and ripple effects in cattle markets. Don't overly focus on what is happening today, but make policies for the future.
Policies to address challenges such as packing capacity, increased transparency in price discovery, and expanding market opportunities for producers of all sizes. Kerry Jacobs of the University of Missouri says one way to assure small-scale livestock producer ownership will have opportunity for success is through cooperative-style models, with emphasis on the cooperation.
Concentration in the livestock industry, particularly at the processing stage, seems inevitable from an efficiency lens. Through cooperation, however, livestock producers can participate in generating and receiving the value this efficiency creates. When at scale, producer ownership can smooth variability in producer incomes because it allows them to capture income from downstream markets that may be less volatile.
She believes that could come in the form of contracting.
We do have examples of large-scale producer ownership in pork. Triumph Foods is producer-owned, and its structure reflects the characteristics of cooperatives that discipline a market. The producer's owners have long-term contracts to sell hogs, and they effectively earn wholesale meat prices for their animals.
Cooperation will also play a key part in preventing future cyber attacks on segments of our nation's beef supply chain. That according to the University of Minnesota's Jennifer Vandelite. She says USDA, Homeland Security, and FBI coordination and collaboration is needed in the way of risk reduction and cybersecurity education efforts although...
Not only does managing cyber risk increase operational costs, but there are very few experts with the knowledge and experience to effectively enhance cybersecurity in the food and ag operational environment. This type of expert is often recognized as irreplaceable. We need to train and field many more of them.
Vandalite adds the threat of cyber attacks on food systems will continue to grow due to the integration of IT systems within the supply chain, hence the priority to fortify these networks from cyber incidents. An example of the impacts of compromised systems is the shutdown of one of the only two milk jug preform plants in the nation during Hurricane Katrina.
The supply of fluid milk at the consumer level plummeted to shortage levels in many areas of the country, while dairy farmers dumped millions of gallons of milk.
Rabo AgriFinance's Dustin Ahern adds that differentiated product models in the beef supply chain.
Alternative marketing agreements are the best way to secure a consistent supply of such differentiated cattle. Strong vertical supply chain relationships will be critical to the success of any new beef business.
And increased technology development.
Startups are also bringing outside expertise to advance technology and automation. 1% improvement in volume efficiency across all existing plants would add 1,000 head of daily fed cattle processing capacity.
Will play a part in building the resiliency of the nation's beef supply chain, both now and in the future. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.